Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaskan Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This week, the United Nations is meeting on climate change. Climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe says it's up to citizens to lead.
The three most important things for any individual person to do, first of all, talk about it. Second of all, join an organization that amplifies your voice. Engage with and talk to leaders at the community level, at the institutional level, at the state level, and vote.
Also on the show, dysfunctional leadership goes way back. Shakespeare scholar and dramaturge Janice Lull says in Macbeth, it isn't clear opposing tyranny is enough.
In this play, for example, there's a challenger to Macbeth, and in some productions, this challenger, this young guy, is interpreted as kind of evil himself.
I hope you'll stick around. Last week, millions of young people and supporters around the globe gathered to protest inaction by world leaders on climate change. This week, some of those leaders are gathered at the UN to discuss the matter. But absent from any leadership role is the United States. Indeed, Mr. Trump has long denied climate science, and he and his administration have rolled back environmental policies, emission standards on vehicles, and have championed greater use of fossil fuels. Despite these developments, my first guest says a majority of Americans polled identify climate change as an important issue. Catherine Hayhoe is not only a respected atmospheric scientist, but also an evangelical Christian who has emerged as an important voice for bridging the divide between religion and science. She recently visited Fairbanks and offered two well-attended talks. As it happens, Hayhoe was raised in a family passionate about both science and faith. Her father was a science teacher, and her parents, evangelical missionaries.
As a Canadian, I grew up spending almost every single day in the summer outside, and fishing was a big part of my life. But it wasn't just about fishing. My dad was a science teacher, so we would count the different species of fish we caught and where certain species like to live and what was the average length and all of that.
And did you like that as a kid? I mean, was that exciting to you, or did you just go, oh, Dad, it's another trout?
Well, sometimes, yes, but my dad was a really good teacher. He's one of those teachers that make what he's interested in sound like the funnest thing in the world.
Now, I understand on vacations, you guys would pack a station wagon just for a telescope.
The telescope went on every family vacation, and in fact, some family vacations were planned around astronomical events like Halley's Comet. So we had a station wagon, and all three kids and the telescope would be packed into that station wagon. And my dad still has one today. So when we go on family trips, we have to always have a vehicle that fits the telescope.
Now, did your siblings also go into science?
Well, my mom is an English and history teacher, and she is a great storyteller. So I grew up on the most amazing creative stories. We had a different story to go with each type of soup and sandwich that we would have for lunch.
So, do you remember any of those stories?
Yes. So tomato soup was my favorite because that was where the castle stories. About these kids who lived in a castle who kept discovering, you know, hidden passageways and secret tunnels and, of course, treasure or interesting artifacts. Chicken noodle soup were the cowboy stories, and every different type of soup had a different type of story. So I have two sisters. One of them has a double degree in chemistry and art. She is an artist. She's a painter, and she also edits an engineering journal.
Wow.
Then my second sister has a double degree in math and linguistics. She was originally a math teacher and decided to go back to school, get her master's again in linguistics. And now she works with a tribe in southern Mexico who doesn't have a written language.
You wanted to be an astrophysicist. Now, I could see how that would follow with the telescope on every vacation. Why didn't you go on into astrophysics?
Well, it goes back quite a ways in the family because it turns out my dad comes from a family of eight. And his name is Douglas, which was not a family name. So we always wondered, well, you know, why was he called Douglas? And he recently found out it's because his own mother had a degree in science education, which as a woman was a very unusual thing to have in the 1940s. And she worked as a research assistant for Dr. Vibert Douglas, who's the first female astrophysicist in Canada. Mm-hmm. So she named him after that astrophysicist. And he loves astrophysics. One of my first memories is going to the park with him when I was about 4 years old and him showing me how to find the Andromeda Galaxy through binoculars. So, I mean, when it's so cool that we can study the far edges of the universe using nothing more than our little brains on this relatively insignificant planet, how could you not want to be an astrophysicist?
Yeah.
So I was almost there. I had almost finished my undergraduate degree. I had already worked as a research assistant. I had published, co-authored 5 papers on variable stars and galaxy clustering around quasars, and I was looking forward to moving on to graduate school. But I needed an extra course to finish my degree. And I'd already, finished a minor in Spanish, and I'd already taken children's literature and all those interesting classes. So I looked around, and over in the geography department, there was a new class that year called climate science. I thought, well, that looks interesting. Why don't I take it? And, I knew climate change was real, but I had mentally lumped it with environmental issues. So air pollution, water pollution, biodiversity loss, deforestation, climate change, environmental issues that environmental people care about and that I would, support the work that they are doing because we do need to fix these problems. But I had never connected the dots and realized that climate change is, as the U.S. military calls it now, a threat multiplier.
What does that mean?
It takes all of the issues and challenges we already confront today and it exacerbates them or makes them worse. So yes, it takes environmental issues and makes them worse, but it takes health issues, it takes economic issues, it takes, and this was most important for me, humanitarian issues and makes them worse. It exacerbates poverty and hunger and disease. It widens the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And to me, that's what struck me the hardest, the idea that it is profoundly unfair, profoundly unjust. The people who contributed least to the problem are suffering the brunt of the impacts. And serendipitously, somehow, I had the exact skill set that you needed to do climate science. It's the same physics you learn in astrophysics. So at that point, I felt compelled to change my trajectory. I thought, how can I, knowing that I have the ability to make a difference, how can I not help with this urgent problem? And it's so urgent, surely we'll fix it soon, and then I can go back to astrophysics. That was 25 years ago.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yes.
When did you meet your husband? Because he's a minister, isn't he?
He is. Well, we met in graduate school when he was finishing his PhD in applied linguistics, and he was a professor for a number of years. He just recently switched careers to being a full-time pastor and a radio host. He has a call-in show daily on Sirius XM on their family talk station. And we met at graduate school in a Christian group called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. I had, at that point in my life, I had never met anybody who didn't think that climate change was real. And for him, growing up in the South with a very conservative family, he had never met anybody who shared his faith who thought that it was. So we'd been married about 6 months before we figured out we were on opposite sides of the spectrum on this issue.
You'd think it would kind of come up earlier.
But we just took it for granted.
Yeah.
If you've never met anybody, then why would you think this person who you have so much in common with, you don't go around asking somebody, do you agree the sky is blue? And that was kind of the way we both felt about our perspectives.
Yeah. How did you two then work that sudden revelation out? Did you, you always had a common faith base. Mm-hmm. So did that help the process?
Yes. What helped is the fact that we already not only loved each other, which definitely helps, but we respected each other.
Uh-huh.
So I knew that he was a really smart person. I mean, he had a PhD. He was an endowed professor at the University of Notre Dame at age 27. He did quantitative research. He understood statistics and data. So I knew that he was really smart and he could put facts together. So I figured if he doesn't think that climate change is real, he must have some good reasons. And I should listen to those reasons because he wouldn't just pull this thing out of a hat. But he felt the same about me. He knew that I was not just a smart person, but for him, I think it was more important. He knew I was an honest person. He knew that I'm not the type of person who would make something up. He certainly knew that we weren't financially profiting from this. That was obvious from our bank account. So he knew that he could trust me. And I knew that I could respect him. And so from that position of mutual trust and mutual respect, we were able to have constructive conversations, which in this day and age we so often can't have because we cannot begin those conversations with mutual respect, let alone trust.
When you're an adolescent, your faith life generally tends to blossom at some point. If your family's religious. Was your family religious, and when did that kick in for you?
Very much so. My family has been part of the evangelical church going back multiple generations, and it was a big part of our lives. So with my dad being a science teacher, I actually grew up with the idea that science and faith cannot be in conflict, because if we truly believe that God created everything that we see in this amazing universe, then how could what we learn from studying his creation with the brains that he gave us ever be in conflict with what he tells us?
Mm.
And maybe sometimes the Bible and science might appear to be in conflict, but it's more likely due to our own limited interpretation of one or the other, or most likely both. And, you know, with some patience and humility, we might be able to figure it out. Sometimes we might not in our lifetime. But if you start from the basic premise that they're compatible with each other, you end up in a very different place than, unfortunately, the premise I feel like too many people have today, which is that somehow God's creation and his word are fundamentally incompatible with each other.
Yeah, so I know they jailed Galileo in the house arrest, et cetera, over time. Is there a conscious thing going on about this polarization of science and religion?
There absolutely is. And of course, it started at the time of Galileo for political reasons. Many of the Jesuit astronomers, Jesuits are still famous for their astronomy today, many of them were aware of and agreed with his findings, but his findings were challenging the eminence of the Pope in the political sphere. And unfortunately, that's what we see today. Is there anything fundamentally unchristian about believing that God gave us responsibility over every living thing on this planet, that we are to care for and love the poor and the vulnerable in this world, the very people who are most affected by a changing climate? And of course, to top it all off, in the book of Revelation, it says God will destroy those who destroy the earth, indicating there is human agency in this process. There's nothing unchristian with agreeing with the Bible. Yet, we live in a world now where we are deliberately told, and this message is deliberately framed, that somehow climate science is an alternate religion with false prophets that worship creation rather than the creator. And so as a Christian, when we're confronted with a false religion, we know that we should reject it. Whereas in reality, it's exactly the opposite. Rejecting climate science actually fulfills more of the requirements of a religion than accepting what God's creation actually tells us. So we're being accused of exactly what's happening on the other side.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, who was recently in Fairbanks. When we return from the break, the single thing we can all do about climate change. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This episode, I'm speaking with Catherine Hayhoe. She heads up Texas Tech's Climate Center. She recently posted a TED Talk which triggered some interesting reactions. Let's get back to the conversation.
Your TED Talk was framed around what's the one thing anybody can do about climate change, and it was conversation. How did you hit upon that?
Yeah. Well, what I found in following public opinion across the U.S., there's this really great set of maps called the Yale Climate Opinion Maps. So if you just go online and you Google Yale Climate Opinion 2018, they'll pop right up. And they have people's answers to about 25 different questions related to climate change across the U.S. by county and by congressional district. And they have the full data for Alaska, too. So it's really revealing to look at what people actually think. It turns out that over 70% of people across the U.S. and a slightly higher number in Alaska agree that climate is changing. It will affect plants and animals. It will affect future generations. It will affect people in developing countries. A slightly lower number say, yes, it will affect people in the United States even. But then you say, do you think it will affect you personally? And the numbers plummet. And you think, well, okay, that's bad news. Everybody thinks somehow it'll affect their neighbor, but not them. And then they asked a question which has the largest negative response of any question they asked. The question that the most people across the whole U.S. say no to is, do you ever talk about it or hear somebody else talking about it? So that's what prompted me to recognize that these conversations are what we're missing. Because, connect the dots here, If you don't talk about something, why would you care? We talk about what we care about. If we don't care about it, why would we act and demand that others do too? So climate action, fixing this problem, truly does begin with a conversation today.
Mm. It's always encouraging when people listen to you, I'm guessing. But it seems like a village in the UK really took that point you just made to heart.
Yes. So my TED Talk was released last December, and you can find it online if you just Google my name, Hey-Ho and TED. And in May, I was in the UK for a visit somewhat like here, where I do a lot of different talks in a lot of different places. And at one of my talks, an older man came up to me afterwards, a community member, and said, "I watched your TED Talk, and I live in a little town outside of London, and so I decided that we needed to have climate conversations. So I've kept a record of how many conversations we've had in my town." Oh, I said, "Fantastic, can I see it?" You know, expecting maybe a few dozen, maybe 100 conversations. So he pulls out this sheaf of papers, and he says, "We have had 10,000 conversations about climate change in my town since December. And because of that, our town council just declared a climate emergency."
I love TED Talks, by the way. And I just watched another one where the presenter said, "We are a species that loves stories." And if you can frame the question or any question, his was an economic question, but he said, if you can frame it in a compelling story, you'll more likely grab people's attention and allegiance. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's true?
Oh, completely. In fact, the reason why we have so much resistance and rejection of basic scientific facts that we've known since the 1800s, the fact that digging up and burning coal and gas and oil produces heat-trapping gases that are wrapping an extra blanket around the Earth, causing it to warm, the fact that there's so much resistance to that is because those who have a vested interest in maintaining our use of oil and gas and coal as long as possible have actually framed some very compelling and very clever stories around why we need to reject this science. Stories that have to do, for example, with this is a false earth-worshipping religion, and true believers will hold to the gifts that God has given us. Because, you know, especially in the 1800s, coal and gas and oil were framed very much as gifts from God. And they really are. They are gifts from God. But just as you give your toddler a gift that you would not give your teenager, in the same way, it's time for us to move on from the gifts that we got back in the 1800s to the ones we have today, which come in the form of the wind and the sun and the tides and more. Another very compelling story, of course, is the idea that the government is out to control your life. That's a very
common
story. Yes. And so climate change feeds naturally into it because we need collective solutions. Individually, we are not enough to solve the problem. We have to act collectively. Collectively often implies policies or government solutions or interventions, and that implies the government telling you what to do. So there's this perception that the government is going to tell you what type of car or truck you can or can't drive, how much water you can or can't use. They're going to rip your stove out of your dead and dying hands. And that fits very much into the narrative of we don't trust the government, we are independent, we make our own choices. So the stories on the side of rejecting the science have actually, unfortunately, been much more compelling than the stories on the side of the science, even though as scientists, we feel like the science is quite compelling enough.
I heard you talk about you went to this conservative Christian university, and I thought to myself when you started that story that it's like Daniel going into the lion's den.
It did sort of feel like that, but I've done this a few times now, and so far I've survived mostly unscathed. So what I find is people are often kind of hesitant to have you come until they've actually heard you speak. So often a lot of my invitations come from one person who heard me speak, and the rest of the people there at that organization are not so keen on having a climate scientist come. But there's one advocate who says, it's okay, I heard her speak, she's going to be all right, she really is a Christian, or, you know, she's really not going to say something totally egregious and offensive. And so they invite me. So I've known a number of other scientists who are Christians around the country for some time, and one of them worked at this very conservative university, and really out of the blue, he contacted me and said, would you be willing to come and speak? I think it's really important that you should come and speak here at this university. So I said, well, actually, I was already going to be in the neighborhood on a certain date. Would it be okay if I just came over, you know, that day? And he said, yeah, we'll make it work. So we arranged the dates, and he said, I'll even come pick you up and drive you over. And then about a week or two before, I got an email from him, and he said, I just wanted to let you know, not in a very alarmed or concerned way, but just letting you know what a few people think. So in the email were copied emails from prominent administrators at his university, basically chastising him for saying, how could you invite this woman who is here to spread Satan's lies? She's here to tell everyone the only solutions to climate change are abortion and killing babies. How could you invite somebody like that to our campus who so violates our values? So he didn't seem too fussed by it. So I said, well, you know, is it okay? I'll still come. Are you still all right with it? He said, oh, absolutely. I just wanted to let you know. So I said, all right, I'm coming. And what I'm going to do is, and I found that this is often very, very successful, is I'm going to tackle these myths myself. I'm not going to wait for somebody in the Q&A to stand up and say, well, are you saying the only solution is population control, which implies abortion, especially in developing countries? I'm going to bring it up myself. And I'm going to talk about how, as Christians, we are pro-life. But pro-life is not from conception to birth. Pro-life is from conception to death. And the reason why I care about a changing climate is because it exacerbates poverty and hunger and disease, and it disproportionately affects the poorest and most vulnerable people, including the unborn children and mothers. And so I went through a whole talk on how, if we truly are pro-life, we would be out at the front of the line demanding climate action, because one in six deaths around the world is due to pollution. The impacts of climate change fall disproportionately on women and children. So after that, he got another email. And the email said, from the same one of the same administrators, it said, you know what? That wasn't what I expected. In fact, it was pretty good. I figured, hey, mission accomplished.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist who Time magazine tapped as one of the 100 most influential people on the planet. When we return from the break, why many people aren't swayed by the facts. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This episode, I'm talking with climate scientist and evangelical Christian Catherine Hayhoe, who recently offered several talks in Fairbanks. Let's get back to the conversation.
It still strikes me that if you can just dispassionately lay out the evidence to somebody, they'll get it and they'll be convinced by it and change their opinion. But really, you're talking about framing it as a narrative more than just laying out the facts.
So when an issue is not politicized at all, when it has no intersection or bearing on our personal identity, then laying out the facts absolutely can make a difference. So, for example, unless you belong to the very small academic community that hotly debates the nature of dark matter, if you're anybody else and you...
I feel strongly about this, so don't tread lightly.
Okay, all right. Well, aside from you and some astrophysicists, if you thought one thing about dark matter and then you read an article saying actually it's quite different, you would say, oh, okay, and change your mind. Because it has no bearing on who you see yourself to be, how it affects your life. There's no personal aspect to it at all. But if there is a personal aspect to it, that will not work at all, because when we are faced with or confronted with facts, scientific peer-reviewed facts, that contradict part of what we believe ourselves to be, we will reject those facts. And actually, the smarter and more educated we are, the better we are at just cherry picking the little pieces of information that show that we're right, rather than changing our minds when we see the facts.
Yeah, in fact, it turns out that people who are the most highly educated are the most polarized on issues. And you would think, whoa, wait a minute. You know, that can't be. But you say that the evidence shows otherwise.
Yes, because the smarter we are, the better we are at picking just the pieces of information that we need to show how we're right. So, you know, my husband and I have some rip-roaring arguments because we're really good at picking the information to justify our position.
Yeah. Is it toilet paper in or out
that's
of the
roller?
That's
pretty much the nature of it. Also, okay. How to load the dishwasher and things like that. Yes. Maybe some arrangement of the furniture, too. But yes. So that's why this is so challenging. And so that's why when we have these conversations about climate change, just overwhelming whoever it is that we're talking with the facts and the data is really not going to change a lot of minds, because the issue is not that they sincerely doubt the reality of nonlinear fluid dynamics. Like, that's really not the issue. The issue is that they believe, because we've been told, that the only solutions to climate change are punitive, are harmful, that will leave us worse off than before, that will decrease our quality of life. And if we're told that the only solutions to this problem are ones that will actually harm us, then why would we want to fix it? But we don't want to say subconsciously, sure, it's real, but I don't want to fix it, because that would make us a bad person, because we know that there are many people, especially here in Alaska, who are already suffering deeply from these impacts. So it's a form of subconscious self-defense that we have to reject the reality of the problem, because rejecting the reality makes us kind of smart. Like, oh, I know more than all those egg-headed scientists. I can see through their, you know, their fabricated data that they're just trying to use to line their pockets with government grants, is the kind of thing people say. So that kind of makes us seem like a smart person, a shrewd person. Whereas if we say, oh, it is real, but I don't want to fix it, that would make us a bad person, somebody who doesn't care about other people. So our own defense mechanism demands that rather than being honest and upfront about the fact that we don't think there are solutions, which of course there are solutions, rather than just rejecting the science. And so that's why when we have a conversation, talking about the solutions is really important, but not punitive solutions, talking about the fact that, you know what, we need energy. We have to have energy. Alaska is actually, just like Texas, well known for energy production. We also need jobs. What are some ways in this clean energy transition that is happening, whether we like it or not, because China is actually leading the way, what are some ways that we could work together to ensure the future of Alaska? To make sure that we have the energy we need, that we're cleaning up our air while we're doing it, that we're providing local jobs to people, that we're increasing our efficiency, decreasing our energy costs, making our lives more livable and better than they were before, not worse, so that we all get to move forward together into that better world that we all want.
Unfortunately, I can hear some people and friends of mine hear this and say, hey, until we can shift the political spectrum, we're not going to, that's not going to happen. It's Pollyannish just to think about conversation and narrative. And of course, there are political leaders out there in our country that think, A, that the results will be bad economics and that climate change is a hoax.
Well, I would stop you there. They think A, but they use B as an excuse.
So it's a subterfuge, or it's, you know, a stalking horse. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Well, that being the case, besides having conversations, are there other aspects that we should think about moving forward to affect change?
We do have to be honest about the magnitude of the challenge we face. So when you look at the economic costs of climate change, we are already seeing those costs today. It's no longer a future issue. The economic costs overwhelm the costs of transition, overwhelm them over any time frame longer than a couple of years. For some places with co-benefits, it's almost immediate. So you might say, well, if that's the case, then why aren't we doing it? It's because today, the benefits of continuing to use fossil fuels go primarily to those who already hold the balance of wealth and power in this world, whereas the impacts, the costs, are socialized, to use that word that they don't want to.
Right.
We are already, each of us as taxpayers, paying the cost, and those at the furthest end of the socioeconomic spectrum, the poorest and most vulnerable, here in Alaska, across the U.S., and around the world, are paying for the benefits that they are enjoying. And so those who make the decisions in this world, those who have the power and the wealth in this world at this time, they have every motivation to maintain the status quo as long as possible, even if it comes at the net expense of their country and the world.
Mm.
And that is the challenge that we have, because we have to move into the future together. We still need energy in the future. We can't just return to the Middle Ages or the Stone Ages. I don't want to do that myself either. The biggest corporations in the world, if you look at the Wikipedia or the Fortune 500 list of the richest corporations in the world, about 8 out of 10 of them owe their wealth, at least in part, if not primarily, to either extraction, processing, or using fossil fuels. So we need to move with them, not against them. But they, in turn, need to take responsibility for the fact that the world is changing, and keeping people using buggies and horses when the Model T Ford is already rolling off the assembly line is not the answer. The world progresses. And not only does it progress, we're also facing some extremely negative, expensive, and even potentially dangerous impacts from continuing to depend on fossil fuels as our primary source of energy.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm speaking with climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe. After this break, finding solutions at the ballot box. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This episode, I'm speaking with evangelical Christian and respected climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe. I spoke with her recently when she was in Fairbanks. As you'll hear, besides discussing climate change, she urges concerned citizens to join like-minded groups and vote.
So is it at the ballot box that we need to also focus attention?
We do. I would say now that the three most important things for any individual person to do, first of all, talk about it. Second of all, join an organization that helps to amplify your voice, that shares your values. There's organizations for hunters and fishers and winter athletes. There's organizations for moms and dads and parents. There's organizations here locally in Fairbanks that care about the city itself as well as Alaska. Join an organization that amplifies your voice. Engage with and talk to leaders at the community level, at the institutional level, at the state level, and vote. Climate change is not a political issue. It shouldn't be. The thermometer doesn't give us a different answer depending on if we're Democrat or Republican. If there's a Republican solution, I am 100% for it. If there's a Democrat solution, I think that's great. If there's a bipartisan solution, I think that's even better. We just need a solution. And to get those solutions, we have to all work together.
Mm. One of the stories you shared was your grandfather and how blood is thicker than thawing permafrost in that regard. So in some ways, he was antithetical to your message, but because of love and affection, he came around, right?
He did. For my grandpa, being proud of his grandchildren was more important than his political ideology. And so he became one of my greatest advocates. And he just passed away a few months ago now, at the age of 96. So,
wow.
So well on in life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I was just at a family event last week. My alma mater, Victoria College at the University of Toronto, honored my aunt and I with honorary doctorates in the same ceremony.
Wow.
Which
How
was
cool
amazing.
Is that?
My aunt's husband is not really on board with climate change, and for him, the blood and permafrost was not quite as thick. So through my little talk, we each got about 3 minutes to talk. My sister was sitting near him. He was actually starting to harumph and mutter and say, no, that's not right. And at one point, he actually yelled out nonsense so loud that my aunt had to turn around and glare at him until I was finished. So we all have these experiences. We all have family members. We all have people we know, an old college roommate, a neighbor, a relative. And some people we can't have these conversations with because if we're not willing to respect each other, and this is the first lesson I learned with my husband, we cannot have a constructive conversation. So if we feel like we cannot genuinely respect somebody else, we're not the right person to have that conversation with them, but somebody else might be. But if they are not willing to respect us when we've extended that respect to them, it's really tough even then to have a good conversation. And that might be a case to say, you know what, we're just going to table this for now, but we'll come back to it. And if you ever have any questions or if I can help you with any good info, please let me know.
Mm. You know, you're such an optimistic person and you're such a good communicator. Did those elements help you in this process of bridging divides?
I think the optimism definitely helps because climate change is a really depressing field to be in.
Totally.
Every new study that comes out shows us that something is changing faster or to a greater extent than we thought, or it's impacting us in new ways that we didn't even know. So my hope and my positivity does not come from the science. It comes from engaging with people and seeing how really amazing people are making an incredible difference. In their local community, in their local organization, a child at their school, a person who's a squeaky wheel at their church, at the scale of an entire town, a state, or even a country. I also think, though, that practice makes perfect. So I have had thousands of these conversations, and there have been conversations that have ended very poorly. There have been utter failures. There have been spectacular flameouts. But every single time I think to myself, how could I have done that differently? Sometimes the answer is nothing. But often the answer is, well, you know, I mean, here's where the conversation really went off on a tangent. Here's where we kind of lost the focus on things that we could do together to actually help with this issue. Here's where it kind of got distracted into the weeds or their hobby horse galloped off into the sunset. Or here's where I accidentally said something that was really offensive and I used a word that didn't mean much to me, but obviously kind of triggered them. There's, you know, certain words in certain communities that you just don't want to use. In some communities, the word divestment is a really awful word. The idea that big investment funds are divesting themselves of fossil fuel resources. And of course, the word denier is a very loaded word that I try never to use because it immediately shuts the door on a positive conversation and it does not engender mutual respect. Practice really does make perfect. So if you're feeling nervous about having that first conversation, start from the heart. Start with something that you care about, that you share with the person you're talking to. Connect the dots about why you're concerned and how climate change is affecting something that you both care about. And then always, always, always end by talking about a positive, beneficial solution that they could get on board with that actually makes sense for you in the place where you're at, that has good impacts for you, for your life, for your community, and also reduces carbon emissions at the same time.
You know, I could see how having a strong faith life and a spiritual foundation also helps in that regard. You have a wider context in order to evaluate things, and it must be helpful to have that carry you a little bit. Would that be right?
Oh, it absolutely does. So something that really kind of struck me this past year was when the Bible, in the book of Romans, it talks about hope. And it talks about it in a completely different way that we would naturally assume that hope arises. It starts with suffering, and it says suffering produces perseverance, perseverance produces character, and character produces the hope that does not disappoint, the hope being placed in God rather than in other humans who will always disappoint us. And that's just a completely different perspective than we would normally have. And so recognizing that through these struggles, we can persevere. And through the perseverance, we develop the character. And through the character, we understand that our hope is not in things here, not in individual people, not in hoping that a certain piece of legislation will pass or hoping that a certain person will do a certain thing. Our hope is above that. And that's the hope that you fix it almost like on God as an unwavering star, not here on this earth. It is not changing depending on the circumstances. And so you can be buffeted to and fro by circumstances that make you feel very hopeless in the moment, for sure. And I've certainly had those dark nights. But recognizing, again, that the hope ultimately does not come from us, I think is so important because I've seen so many people pin their hopes on a specific thing happening.
Mm.
And when that thing doesn't happen, it can just be devastating. Like, you know, entire groups of people just giving up after a piece of federal legislation was not passed that they'd worked for years to push through. And we were being left with no climate legislation for the ensuing 10 years because that one piece didn't go through. That's very depressing.
Yeah, totally.
But in order to keep going, we need that hope. And that hope comes from looking at what people are doing, looking at what others are doing, but then recognizing ultimately that we can't pin our hope on any specific thing here in this world.
I'm talking right now with Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist who's also someone, as you can hear, who's faith-based. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Links to Hey Ho's website are on the Northern Soundings page. When we return from the break, the Bard Scottish King. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater mounted the play Macbeth. I had the opportunity to talk with both its dramaturge Janice Lull and director Rebecca George. Last week we heard from George, and this episode, Shakespeare scholar and UAF professor emerita Lull explains the role of the dramaturge and why Macbeth is one of Shakespeare's great plays. I began by asking Lull if she remembers what the first play by Shakespeare she saw was.
You know, I think it was Romeo and Juliet when I was in high school, because Romeo and Juliet is the play that they always teach to people in high school, or at least they used to. I think that's the first live Shakespeare that I saw. And then when I was in college, I saw a lot of them in Oregon. The Oregon Shakespeare Festival was going, and I was at the University of Oregon. So I saw a lot of plays down there.
Did that first show of Romeo and Juliet that you saw give you the bug to become a Shakespeare scholar? When did you make that decision?
I think that was when I was in college. It wasn't so much seeing live productions. For me, it was the language, the poetry, and studying poetry. You know, I came up in the 60s when the New Criticism was happening, a very close examination of language, and that's when I realized that Shakespeare was just the best poet to study. I still think that.
Mm-hmm. And where do we know where Macbeth lies in the canon? Is it in his middle period, his late period, his early period?
Well, it's late. It's in the 17th century. After Elizabeth died and her cousin James came down from Scotland to take over the throne, and it's just at that time that Shakespeare writes this play about a Scottish king. And there was a Scottish king who had taken over the throne in England, so it's topical in its time, just at the change of power in England in the early 17th century. So I guess it's late-ish Shakespeare.
As a scholar, of course, you pore over historic material or other criticisms and the original text itself. Tell me about approaching it as a scholar as opposed to as in dramaturgy.
In dramaturgy, working with a cast, putting on a show, sometimes the historical things are important, but often it's just the nuances of the text itself. What does it mean? What could it mean? What if people said that it means? What has scholarship argued about various points? The printing of the original text of Macbeth was in the first folio. And some Shakespeare plays have earlier editions, like Richard III, which I worked on, had 8 earlier editions before the collected works came out. And it seems like it was a popular one for people to buy at a bookstall and take home and read. Macbeth isn't like that. It only showed up this one time in this one book. So people in the theater, too, like to know, what did it say in the original book? What is the printing? What is the folio reading? What do people say about that? Could there be mistakes in the folio? If there are mistakes, how should we change our production and so on?
I would assume or guess that as a scholar, a Shakespeare scholar, you get to choose what you want to focus on and the interpretation you want to adopt or you think is most revealing for the text. But as a dramaturg, you got to work with a cast. You got to work with a director. Talk to me about that process.
Well, yeah, the director rules in a production. The dramaturge doesn't. The dramaturge works for the director and for the cast, really. So one of the things I used to do before Google was look stuff up for people. They would say, what is a halberd, actually? What is this weapon that I'm supposedly hitting someone with? And I'd go to the library and I'd get a picture of it and I'd bring it. I don't have to do that anymore because anyone can Google a halberd who wants to. But in terms of the interpretation, it's the director who decides. In this play, for example, there's a challenger to Macbeth, who is the son of the dead king. And in some productions, this challenger, this young guy, is interpreted as kind of evil himself. And in some productions, he's not. He's the innocent young prince who's going to fix everything. And so whether he's the innocent young prince or a possible evil successor is up to the director, not to me. I have my interpretation of what I think Shakespeare might have thought, but it doesn't matter. What matters in a production is what the director thinks.
You've served as dramaturge. What does that mean?
Well, it means sort of the literary scholarship person who's associated with a play. So in a modern play, sometimes if the playwright is alive, the dramaturge works with the author, goes out and interviews the author and talks about intention and talks about negotiating what the author thought compared to what the production is doing. Obviously, the dramaturge doesn't do that if the author is not alive. So then it's more research. What could the author have intended? What documents are there out there that indicate what the author would have wanted? And in Shakespeare's case, there aren't any such documents. So it's focused on the text itself.
Now, there must be reams of scholarship that is generated every year. How does a dramaturge then keep up with that to find out, but maybe there is a new interpretation or a halberd turns out to be a shoe buckle?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, there's new scholarship every few minutes and nobody can encompass it all. Nobody can master it all. It's for the dramaturge working with the director, the question is, what does she want to know? What would she like researched? And then you go to the sources that feed into the director's interest or the interest in this particular production. Somebody in the cast asked me, what was it really like in the 11th century in Scotland? Now, this play was not written in the 11th century. It was written in the 17th century. But the events, insofar as there is any history from way back in Macbeth's time, those events took place in the 11th century in Scotland. So this actor wanted to know, just for information, what was it really like in the 11th century in Scotland? So I did some research on that, insofar as you can find out anything, since the Scots were not into writing things down in those days. So a lot of the information about 11th century Scotland comes from the Icelandic sagas, interestingly enough, because they did write things down.
Do you enjoy, as a scholar, working as a dramaturge? You've done it so often now, Janice. You must enjoy the process.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, if you read these texts in a library or in an edition of Shakespeare, it's entirely different to see them brought to life, to see people walking and talking and reciting these lines and putting spin on them and wearing costumes. It's just really exciting if you've spent your time poring over the text.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm talking with Shakespeare scholar and dramaturge Janice Lull. When we return from the break, Skirting Curses. Well, Welcome back. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I'm talking this episode with Janice Lull, Professor Emerita from UAF and respected Shakespeare scholar. She also served Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater this summer as dramaturge. Let's get back to our conversation.
Unlike many plays of Shakespeare, there's a superstition surrounding Macbeth that you can't mention the name. Where does that come from?
I'm not sure. A lot of these, there is one other play, All's Well That Ends Well, which has a similar superstition. It's not as heavy duty. After all, All's Well is a comedy. But I think it comes from the 18th century when acting Shakespeare was really big in London. And there just developed all kinds of little customs and superstitions around Shakespeare's play. Macbeth, of course, is very dark and supernatural forces indicated and curses, and it's just a natural to develop superstition among actors. All's Well is a little more surprising, but it too the title of it asserts that everything's going to be fine, and there's something suspicious about the idea that everything's going to be fine. So I think it was in the 18th century and developed in London among Shakespearean actors.
Do you find modern casts take it seriously?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they do. And I don't tend to take it seriously as a bookish person, so I have to be careful. The core superstition about Macbeth is that you should not do what I just did, which is say that word in a theater. That's the core superstition. And then there are other superstitions around it. For example, there's a superstition that if you're an actor in this play and you accidentally say your lines outside the theater, you quote your lines from Macbeth, you must say an equal number of lines from A Midsummer Night's Dream to counteract, sort of neutralize what you did by quoting the play.
Well, the supernatural element and this superstition seems sort of oddly compatible here in the production, in the sense that I'm sure Shakespeare, writing about witches, really believed in that time that there really were witches and there were these supernatural events. And cast, I must say, you know, you always in a live performance hope things go your way, but there's so many unexpected problems that can arise that I could see where superstition would be a powerful emotional drive.
Well, it only takes a few accidents on a set for people to decide this is an unlucky play. And then, you know, actors like athletes tend to honor superstition. You know, I wear my lucky shirt. I don't really believe in it, but I wear my lucky shirt anyway, just in case. So just in case, we don't say the word in the theater. And people rehearsing will refer to Mackers instead of the name of the character. Mackers, you need to move further to the left here. Yeah. Not say the word in a theater, just in case. The play lends itself to that. And I don't really know. I can't tell you whether Shakespeare literally believed in witches, but I can tell you that King James literally believed in witches, the guy who came to the throne after the death of Elizabeth and in whose honor this play might have been written. He believed in witches and wrote a book about witches. And so the existence of the witches in this play is undoubtedly a gesture to the king in some way.
Now, for the theater goer, Janice, is there an aspect about the play that you wish they knew sitting down to observe the play? Is there something we ought to know about the play?
I don't know. You know, I feel like I don't want to advise people to read their Shakespeare before they come to study up. That's not always fun. Some people like to do that, and that's great if you like to do it. You'll be more familiar with the action and you'll follow it better. But if you don't want to do it, don't do it. If a play does not sell itself, then it's not a great play, and I think this is a great play.
Are there aspects about the language of this particular play that will go nameless now that we should listen for? Are there unique rhythmic or poetic devices he employs?
Well, I don't think there are any unique ones. Shakespeare employs poetic devices in all his plays. But the verse here is just intense, especially in Macbeth's soliloquies. I think they are right up there with Hamlet's soliloquies, if not more intense than Hamlet's soliloquies. If you want to watch for one thing, watch Macbeth when he's talking to the audience or when he's alone on stage, because that's where he has these beautiful passages that are just so dense with meaning you could listen to them all day. I could.
You know, it always struck me that Lady Macbeth kind of steals so many scenes. It's like a binary star. It's hard to choose which is the central character that undergoes transformation.
That's true. And Lady M, as you should say, that there's a kind of crossing of development. At the beginning, she starts out very sure of what she needs to do and very defiant about the idea that she should be stopped or that morality should enter into her considerations to her ambition. She starts out at the top. I'm going to do it and let everything else clear out of my way. And he starts out doubtful, and they kind of cross in the middle. She becomes, I would say, remorseful, and he becomes nuts. So they are the interaction there. One of the reasons I like this play is that it's just about the most intense marital situation you will ever see in Shakespeare. It's a love story, in a way, a dark love story.
You mentioned the comparison between Hamlet and M. Did you think in some ways Shakespeare's vision mature in handling Macbeth in ways that he didn't when he tackled the character of Hamlet?
Well, that's interesting. Hamlet's pretty mature. You know, he works through some pretty heavy-duty personal problems. But to me, the situation of this character, Mackers we'll call him, is more interesting because he has his own fate in his hands, really. In spite of the witches, in spite of supernatural influences, he decides to do what he does and become what he becomes. Hamlet is reacting. A lot of bad things are done to him or to his father, and he's trying to figure out what to do about it. But Macbeth takes his fate in his hands, at least that's what I think. Compared to classical heroes, this is like a classical play, a Greek play. There's a great fall. He's a hero at the beginning, and truly he is a hero. He's a good guy. He's a soldier, and he kills people, but basically he's loyal and does right. And by the end of the play, he's a terrible villain, and we get to see very condensed that whole progress. And to think, maybe, if we allow the possibility that that could happen to us, we could make such decisions and become bad people. And then the other thing I like about this play is that just when you can't identify with him anymore, when he's slaughtering people right and left, the play backs off and it gives you an alternative. It gives you the young prince who's coming in to defeat Macbeth. And to me, that's very cathartic, especially right now. Take the tyrant down, and they do. And so you're allowed as an audience to back away from this character and not fall with him, but see the catharsis, the cleansing of the state.
Now, you know, in traditional, let's say you mentioned Greek tragedy, the idea is there's a central flaw for the character. Do you think that's a useful way of examining Macbeth? And what would you characterize his central flaw being? Ambition?
That's interesting. You know, Aristotle says that, maybe. It's hard, you know, I don't read Greek. Some people say, it's translated for us and we read it, and it says that the character has a central mistake, not really flaw, like something inside him, but he makes a central mistake. If that's what Aristotle meant, then I think you can look for that in this play. You might find several things. He succumbs to ambition, yeah, and to the blandishments of what appears to be supernatural prediction, and to his wife, to her ambition, too, all three of those.
Well, Janice Lowell, Professor Emerita at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.